Tell me how this sounds. 7 marathons, 7 days, 7 continents.
1 marathon sounds awful to me.
I think the whole thing sounds amazing. It's actually a thing, and it's called the World Marathon Challenge. And heads up, it's on my bucket list.
Okay.
It's expensive, though. It is a very cool thing. And there's this guy, Eric Tozer, who is a type 1 diabetic. He's the first type 1 diabetic to complete the World Marathon Challenge. And his backstory of how he found out he had diabetes and how he decided that diabetes was not going to define his life is fascinating. He's the founder of the Diabetes Sports Project. He's a dad. He's got a job.
He's like a busy guy.
And he hasn't been running very long, although he has literally run around the world now. So I'm just dying to ask, we're going to find out kind of the weird way Eric found out that he was a type 1 diabetic. He had no idea until he was on a guy's trip in Europe. Let your imagination go there. And then in part 2 of the interview, we're going to break down the World Marathon Challenge. It starts in Antarctica, and it goes through Dubai and Australia and South Africa. I mean, it's just awesome. So he's going to break down what this thing was really like. And then we'll also talk about the impact that him completing the challenge has had on the world of diabetes in terms of inspiring lots of people.
Cool.
We're going to make you a runner. Or not. This is Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Eric Tozer, welcome to the Dying to Ask podcast.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us and slowing down, because slowing down is something you finally get to do.
it's been nice to sort of have a little bit of a break coming off of the World Marathon Challenge. But
I've said everyone who took part, I'm sure. start with, you know, a big congratulations. There are not a lot of people who've actually been able to either even take on or complete the World Marathon Challenge, but you did, and in doing so and finishing, you became, tell me if I'm getting this right, but the first person who is a type 1 diabetic to complete the challenge.
That's right. Yeah. It hadn't been done by anybody with type 1 diabetes before. And so wanted to do something kind of crazy and as grand and epic as possible to give the diabetes community, whether it's patients or the healthcare providers or parents or loved ones or anybody, everybody, give them an example of what life with type 1 diabetes can look like and how we can have a full thriving life.
So, well, check. Got that. Let's go back in time, because the story of how you found out that you had type 1 is kind of interesting. And it's not all that long ago. I mean, how old are you now?
Yeah, I turned 35 this next week, and I was diagnosed at 22. I just coming out of a college soccer career. I was actually traveling abroad over in Europe and had no clue. I had classic symptoms, but I was completely oblivious.
So you were on like a guy's trip, the way I've heard the story. You're on like a guy's trip through Europe.
Yeah.
You're smiling, so we'll take that as an affirmative.
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks. It was, you know, the summer of 2006, and so the World Cup was going on in Germany, and you know, being a soccer player, I went over. I didn't go to any games, but just being in that environment.
Oh gosh, just being around them must have been great.
Yeah, for the last, you know, 3-4 games was just magical. But
so what were you noticing on that trip that you thought? And maybe you didn't at the time, but like that was maybe not right.
Yeah. So that's what's fascinating is I didn't know. I was, you know, eating and drinking nonstop. My pancreas essentially had turned off. And so I wasn't producing any insulin. And the insulin is what delivers the glucose to your cells for energy. So without that, without getting too scientific, but basically your body will shut down. And so I was eating nonstop. I was drinking nonstop and having to go pee all the time because that's the body's natural way to sort of try to flush out that excess glucose. And I was losing weight. So over the 2 weeks, I lost about 20 pounds.
20 pounds?
Which to me, I was, you know, I'm sure it's the beer and croissants that I'm eating and drinking. But I was also, I didn't know it at the time. I only looking back now realized it, but I was sort of lethargic and out of energy. But, you know, at the same time, as you said, I'm traveling around Europe, kind of having fun. So I was just kind of oblivious to it. And then I got home, got off the plane, and on the spot, my mom said, you know, I think you have type 1 diabetes. Now, keep in mind, zero family history. You know, we kind of had, you know, one friend, but we didn't. It was just totally just out of the blue. And
did she say that based on like what she saw when she looked at you and maybe some of the things you might have said?
I don't remember exactly what I said, but mother's intuition, right?
So absolutely.
I think the weight loss, you know, for her was more drastic because it was, you know, a full 2 to 3 weeks, right? And for me, it was day to day. And so I think that between that and saying I had been eating and drinking and was mm-hmm. thirsty, you know, she was able to kind of put two and two together. But quick trip to the doctor. I was supposed to start my job, my first kind of job out of college. A month later, quick trip to the doctor, you know, you have type 1. Here's the ABCs of diabetes. Good luck.
Wow.
You know, kind of out the door. And I moved across the country to start my job. And
right.
I had this new thing I had to kind of figure out. And
welcome
learn
to adulthood.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was a bit of a whirlwind of a start.
Coming from, you know, a competitive soccer career, especially at the collegiate level, I mean, it means you're usually pretty in tune with your body. You're very fit, very disciplined. And then to get that thrown at you, what was the most jarring thing about that transition? Because type 1 is not like you treat it for a while and it goes away. I mean, it's a total lifestyle change.
100%. You know, there's no cure. You know, there's about 1.3 million people with type 1 in America and 28-ish million with type 2. So when people hear diabetes, they don't often think of type 1. They don't know there's a difference. So I was in that boat. I didn't know there were two types of diabetes. I didn't know really anything about type 1. All I knew is that there wasn't a cure. And this is something I was going to have to deal with the rest of my life. But even that was sort of all I knew. So then it's learning about, you know, anytime I have carbohydrates, I have to inject insulin. I have to know my blood sugar is 24 hours a day. I mean, those are the very basic fundamentals. But I credit that sort of sports and competitive mindset and framework that I've had in setting me up for success. So even though I didn't know much about this, I decided in that moment that I wasn't going to let it define me. I was going to, and maybe I was naive, right? But I wanted to live the life I wanted to live mm-hmm. and have this thing that I was trying to, you know, figure out match that lifestyle as opposed to saying, okay, gosh, I have this new disease. What do I have to take away? You know, what can't I eat? What can't I do? What, you know, and so that was my mindset from early on. And it was a lot of trial and error and a lot of kind of self-education. But the biggest kind of initial hurdle was I never felt alone, like what was me alone, but I didn't have that resource. You know, there wasn't much out there. Social media 13 years ago didn't look like it does today.
Right.
And so it was a bit of that kind of uncharted territories for me and not really having a guide along the way.
Right. I love how you treated it like probably like you treated training. You know, like that's the beauty of an athlete. When you get into injury time or whatever, you treat the recovery or learning the new lifestyle like you would training.
Yeah. It was definitely, and it still is. It's sort of it's obviously a huge part of my life, both mm-hmm. physically, emotionally, mentally, socially. But it was just another thing that I had to deal with. And, you know, just like I have to warm up or any other component of sort of sports or athletic, you know, or exercise, now my blood sugar numbers and my insulin ratios are all just kind of another part
done.
Of that equation.
So how soon after the diagnosis did Diabetes Sports Project come about?
A handful of years later. So if, you know, since then I've, as corny or cliche as it sounds, I think, you know, we all have something to bring to the world to make it better. Right. And whether that's time, money, athletic, artistic, whatever it might be. And I don't really have any of those, but I, you know,
you have a few other skills. We're going to get into that.
So I from early on said, you know, if I can use my whatever, my mindset, my outlook, my athletic ability with type 1 diabetes as a way to help people, then that's what I'm going to do. And people responded positively. And so, you know, until they tell me to sit down and shut up, I'm going to keep doing it. So it was a few years later, nine of us with type one, that we had kind of connected over the years in this type one diabetes sports arena got together and said, you know, look, we have this tremendous knowledge base of successes and failures and accomplishments and challenges living with type one and having achieved amazing things. That's all great. But if we don't use that as a way to give back and a way to touch people, engage with people and help people and educate, and then we're kind of missing the big picture.
Yeah. So then you start taking on these like really big running challenges because they drew a lot of attention, not only to you guys, but to the cause in general. So list out a couple of things you guys did early in the Diabetes Sports Project history.
Well, yeah, we, you know, cumulatively, we're now over 100 athletes around the world. Everybody's totally volunteer basis, and myself included. You know, we don't take money from it. It's sort of the money goes towards creating weekends like the marathon weekend you and I talked about. But, you know, we've got somebody who's climbed Mount Everest, a young girl who's won a stand-up paddleboarding world championship.
That's awesome.
You know, 10 of us ran from San Diego to New York City, guys and girls that do Ironmans and Ironman World Championship and Boston Marathon and 100-mile marathon champions.
Yeah. So,
which is just crazy, right?
Which is crazy because it's not just completing, it's competing, which is a completely different thing. And when you think about, you know, kind of the chemistry experiment you have going on during a race to make sure you keep all your levels where they need to be, like you add in this other component, which to me just is that much more impressive. And you and I met actually at a marathon expo, gosh, years ago, the California International Marathon. And that was right when you had really started like running in earnest because you hadn't grown up like a lifelong runner or anything.
No, and I'm no longer allowed to say this, but I never really felt like a runner.
Yeah, you can't say that. No, I'm with like the rest of the world. You cannot say that.
yeah, that's no longer going to be an excuse. But you know, I grew up playing sports. You know, my dad's 6'6", right? We played basketball, we played baseball, we swam, tennis, soccer. You know, and then soccer kind of became my sport, and into college, and my thought and intention was to go over to Europe and keep playing. And so that was always, running was something that until, you know, into my mid 20s, I still hadn't really ever done aside from in one of those sports. And so I'm very much self-taught and self-trained. And so it's still something that I consider myself an athlete. I mean, an athletic person. I like all sports, and running and triathlon has kind of been what I've done more so over the last, you know, 8-10 years or so. But
what was the learning curve like trying to transition from just being an athlete to being an athlete that's type one diabetic also?
Yeah, it's a you know, it's much better today than it was for me 13 years ago. Or, you know, I talked to a gentleman this past weekend at an event I was at, he's had it for 50 years, right? And people that are diagnosed with type 1 today have such a greater successful future ahead of them because the tools, the insulin, the technology, our education. I mean, we know so much more. We have so much more at our disposal and these amazing tools to make type 1 management that much easier. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I wear a device that sends, it's called Dexcom. Every 5 minutes, it sends a blood sugar reading to my phone and to my Apple Watch that says what my blood sugar is, what the trending arrow is. And so it's the equivalent of doing 288 finger pokes a day, which is just crazy, right? So I can go to sleep.
It's a good thing you have all that, because when you decided a while back that you were going to take on the World Marathon Challenge, I'm sure there were a lot of people who were like, is this the best idea we could come up with? And of course, it was. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, get ready, because the runner in me is about to totally geek out. My husband is terrified that I'm now going to take this on when I told him I was talking to you. But we're going to break this down. I mean, this is an incredible feat, and we're going to break it down day by day. We'll do that right after this. Hey there, quick time out for a favor for your friend Fitz. If you are enjoying this podcast, and I assume you are because you're still listening, right?
Hopefully.
I hope so. Would you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, please? You can do it straight from the podcast app. Rate us by stars. Heads up. Five is the best.
Five is the best.
The best.
Our boss
loves the five. Yeah. Or you can write us a short review on what you like or maybe what you'd like to see in future podcasts. All right. So, Eric, the World Marathon Challenge, for people who don't know what this is, break it down.
Yeah. So the World Marathon Challenge is an event, a running event. It's been going for 5 years or so now. It's seven full marathons on seven continents in seven consecutive days.
How awesome is that?
Or insane. I mean.
So at what point did you decide, like, at what point does the idea come to you? We should do this.
You know, it was sort of this serendipitous just story. So somebody sent me an article 2 or 3 years ago now about this guy named Mike Wardian who ran this race, and a friend of mine sent it to me and said, hey, you should do this. And somebody that I respect and trust, and I literally laughed out loud when he sent it to me and was like, you know, thank you, but that's way outside of my realm of, you know. And so I put it in a cupboard and didn't even think about it for a couple of years. And then over the past few years, I've tried to find something that hadn't been done in the type 1 community and would drive that excitement. And like you said, like, that's crazy. That's insane, right? Is that even possible? And is that possible, much less with type 1 diabetes? And so I started thinking, you know, I've got a full-time job and I run DSP and we've got kids and family life, right? So I don't have a ton of time. And so what could be kind of crazy impactful, but not take up a whole year or 6 months or 3 months or something. So I came across this and talked with Aaron Kowalski at JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. What are your thoughts? And they loved the idea and sort of to bring both that awareness and empowerment and inspiration to the type 1 community. And so so then the serendipitous part is Mike Wardian, who was on the article 3 years ago or whatever, he ends up doing the race again. He's one of the 40 participants and is my seatmate, and he's one of the best runners in the world. And so it was, you know, kind of neat to have this opportunity to see one of the best do something.
Basically, this is like, it's like a private race. Like you sign up, but I mean, it's crazy expensive. It's a limited number of people. Describe kind of the logistics of it, and then we'll start breaking it into how you actually pulled it off.
Yeah, so it's just like you would sign up for any kind of marathon. This is seven marathons, so each race is just the participants for the World Marathon Challenge in this race. And
so how do you guys get around on, what, a private jet?
Yep, so it's a big chartered plane, kind of a big 737 chartered plane, and we're on that plane the whole time. So essentially, you know, we land in whatever continent or country, get off the plane, get our bags, go through customs, get on a bus, drive to the race location. So maybe it's 30 minutes or an hour. Get off the bus. They set up the race really quickly while we get dressed and prepped. So maybe that's an hour. Do the race. And, you know, people are finishing between, you know, 3 hours and 8 hours. And once everybody's done, pack up, get back on the bus, drive back to the airport, check in, just like you would a regular
and then
flight.
But rinse and repeat, do it all over again.
Rinse and repeat.
What does it cost to do it?
So it's about $40,000 US. And so, you know, it's expensive, and so that's where working with JDRF, we were able to go out to, you know, Hanes and Ford and Medtronic and Sparkling Ice and Garmin and these companies that said, you know, we believe in this, we see the value for doing something to bring
something
inspiration, something big. And so, you know, so fortunate and thankful for those companies because they're the ones that made it possible. And so it was 183 miles. That's kind of how I looked at it, was not seven races, but one big race just kind of split up over 7 days.
No, I know when my girlfriends and I do a marathon the night before, we start this little text chain. Well, what are you wearing? I don't know. What are you wearing? I might go with the leggings, but that's, you know, like you analyze everything. When you're doing this like 7 days and seven continents and like every kind of weather you could possibly do, how much stuff did you bring with you? This is where the geeky runner things can come out. But like, how much gear do you have to bring for something like this?
I had, you know, it's funny. I had 7 perfectly packed little bags, right? They were labeled Antarctica, what was inside, and then Cape Town and Perth and Dubai. And that kind of went out the window after day 2, right? But, you know,
such a great idea on paper, though.
Yes, exactly. Same with my race nutrition, which was a whole other story.
Well, we'll get to that.
the planning, I mean, most of the... It was end of January, that first week of February. So it's summer in Antarctica, which meant it was between about 12 degrees and negative 20 with the wind chill, which meant you really had to be kind of, you know, packing and the logistics was half the battle and more stressful for me than the training, just because I didn't know. I'd done 3 marathons and you know, some Ironman triathlons, but 7 marathons in a row was definitely outside of my comfort zone. A big kind of question mark.
So you get off the plane in Antarctica and you think to yourself as you take that first deep breath of the most frigid air you've probably ever breathed, what?
Yes.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Like, this was the most dumb thing I've ever done.
I was so thankful for the opportunity to do something for the diabetes community and with the diabetes community. And thankful for the opportunity, right? Because we're all so busy. We have jobs, we have families, we have friends, we have so much going on in our life. And I think it's not often that we get to do something to really push our limit to see, like, hey, what am I capable of, right? And for me, it had been a long, long time since I really kind of undertook something that I didn't know I would kind of be able to accomplish. I was confident I would accomplish it because it was, like I said, it was so much bigger than me that I never doubted I would finish.
Right.
But I stepped off that plane in Antarctica and, you know, there was a patch of ice right there and it's another planet, you know, all white and just quiet and ice and snow. And the only real sound is the cracking ice under your feet.
What was it like running there?
So the course, it was a kind of like an oversized track that went around the runway.
Incredibly scenic.
It's just land, then run.
Yeah. Well, yeah, kind of.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, some of the pictures that I've shared so far, it's, you know, you see the plane in the background and we were literally right there. And so portions of that track, if you will, they did a nice job to groom it, but 40 people running, you know, I forget how many loops it was, maybe 8 loops or something around that line. But so part of the course got pretty mushy. There were sections of it that were, you know, solid blue ice. So you're, you know, walking like a penguin to make sure you don't fall. And, you know, it's super bright white. And again, it kind of it's Antarctica, so there's nobody out there.
Right. You don't have a cheering section necessarily.
Yeah.
So you get back on the plane after marathon one, and from what I read, like, the plane is pretty plush. Like, everything, all the seats lined down, you can get kind of comfy. They've got snacks and all that good stuff. What's the conversation like on the plane with the other 39 competitors at that point?
Yeah, it was a bond formed very tightly, very fast. You know, I think you go through something that epic and challenging with people and, you know, 40 strangers, you know, there were some people that were friends, or there was a mother-in-law daughter, there was a father's son, there were 3 married couples. And so, you know, some people knew each other, but for the most part, it's all strangers. And, from around the world, I think 15 countries, all reasons for being there, all walks of life, all experiences. I was kind of the new guy in terms of running. There were some incredibly accomplished runners.
Yeah.
You know, 100 mile, Dan had ran 200 marathons. I mean, you know, just this. So you know, it was very positive and encouraging and, you know, whatever we could do to help anybody else.
You're on this quest together. I mean, it's kind of exciting. So you go from Antarctica to where? What was stop number 2?
So back to Cape Town, South Africa, which
So you sleep on the plane and now you're back to South Africa.
Yeah. Yeah. All sleep, all recovery, everything is on the plane. And so the flight back to Cape Town was only 5.5 hours, which meant, you know, maybe 3 to 4 hours sleep, maybe.
Wow.
I didn't get that much, but you know, and then it was straight off the plane. And that was the hottest race. That was almost 100 degrees, middle of the day. And less than 24 hours before the first race started. So those were the, those two were truly back to back. And then we had a 17 hour flight to Australia for the third one.
That, you know, that you're probably the only person who actually enjoys that really long trip to Australia at that point, because you're like, let's try to recover a little bit. So by the third marathon, how are you noticing your body handling it in terms of the type one? Are you noticing any differences? And how did you, how'd you gauge all of this?
Yeah, the type one component was the biggest obstacle, the biggest sort of unknown, biggest question mark. My endocrinologist, who's one of the best in the world, I mean, I'm so fortunate to have her. We had our plan together and have crafted it over the years, right? We've sort of dialed in, this is how many carbs I need every hour for exercise, for different types of exercise. I take two shots of insulin. Mm-hmm. One I take once a day, and then the other I take every time I have any carbohydrates. And so, it's how do I adjust those? And so we went in with, this is the plan. We think, you know, for that basal insulin that I take once a day, this is what we think we're going to need to do. It's probably going to need to come down by a certain percentage, and it might need to come down more, but then it might come up because of the 7 days of stress on the body, what that does to the various hormones and your blood sugar. So, you know, as great of doctors as we have, and as great of medicine and technology, it's still very individualized, and it's still very much kind of a question mark with how one person will react to different environments or 30,000 sure. flying miles.
I mean, you're kind of like a research experiment.
There was a lot of interest in sort of, you know, what did your blood sugars look like? And so my continuous glucose monitor, my Dexcom, was for me the most important part of kind of my successful diabetes management, the day to day, but especially for this race, because, you know, I kind of set a high and a low, and if I go outside of that, it'll buzz to alert me. And so I'm able to see real time, you know, where my blood sugars are headed. And so it's sort of an on-the-fly decision-making 24 hours a day.
Well, I was following along when this was going on social media. My, just like watching different people on social media, it seemed like by day four, kind of like when you watch that show Survivor, things start to go south sometimes for people personality-wise, because you're really, it's not just the physical thing that you're up against, but you're up against the mental part, which is, I think, in any of these challenges, the hardest part is keeping your brain in the game. So what was it like by the time you got to like day four? Was that Dubai?
So day three was Australia, day four was Dubai. Yeah. I was trying to stay very present and stay in that moment, not think back on the Antarctica, or not think, mm-hmm. you know, ahead to Chile or Madrid. Try to be present for a few reasons, right? Because it's such a unique, each one was such a unique experience. I wanted to enjoy being there. And sort of be present in how my body's feeling, what do I need to do with my blood sugars right now in 45 minutes, you know, there's always something to be thinking about, especially with type one. And so
do you set alerts then to remind you then? Does the Apple Watch remind you of what you need to do?
Yeah, a little bit. So I know that I need about 50 to 55 grams of carbs every hour to keep my blood sugar steady at marathon effort. But when I am not able to eat any food because of, you know, either like in Antarctica, it was so cold that my food plan didn't really go as scheduled. So we kind of got to make decisions on the fly. Other races like Chile and Madrid, I couldn't, and Dubai as well, I wasn't able to stomach food very, very much at all. I had thrown up in Santiago. And so, you know, there's a lot of physical challenges that you can't really prep for in right. terms of, you know, training. And so.
So what really stood out for you then on the road? Like, what are the memories that you look back on, you know, a couple months later and go, gosh, that was amazing.
You know, the experiences kind of with other participants in the journey were special. You know, I shared this story over the weekend, but I ran part of a race with this professional runner, this female from Denmark, who's, you know, crazy fast and just tremendous athlete and competitor. And she came in second place overall. And I ran the last sort of lap and a half of Santiago, Chile with her. And prior to starting to run with her, I was really struggling. She was kind of, you know, we were both in the kind of this dark place, and she was about to lap me. And so I made the decision to sort of, you know, if I'm going to keep up with her and like have her, you know, let's finish her race strong. And then I had another loop or so. And so I'm like, I'm going to pick it up and sort of try to help her, try to, you know, and in doing so, you know, she finished strong, but then what happened is my pace stayed at that higher pace that she and I had ran at. And so it was this added sort of surprise benefit for me. It's something that I've taken into my work and sort of just that teamwork mentality that I've known forever, but it was such a unique example and such a magical kind of surprise that in helping somebody else, I actually had a benefit as well, which just was a complete surprise. But that was certainly neat. Madrid, we ran on a Formula One racetrack in the middle of the night.
So cool.
Which was pretty cool. It was also, oh, I think it was like 1,200 feet of climbing, which meant
that's not cool.
That wasn't very cool.
And each time you land in a different place, I mean, you're getting a stamp in the passport and seeing a country for the first time, maybe in a weird way. And then you get to the final race, which brings you back to North America and to Miami, which is where your family was waiting for you. And then you did something I could not believe. You ran your fastest race of the week, and I clocked a 3-hour 32 marathon after doing 7 of them in the row. Now, was that because you were just saving a little something for the end, or you were just ready to be done?
Yeah, apparently I hadn't tried hard enough prior to that. I went in kind of so inexperienced that I truly didn't know what every day was like. I'm going to go out and run kind of how I feel. Mm-hmm. I don't know what my time should look like. Even my wife was like, hey, what do you think you're going to run these in? I'm like, I have no clue because I don't have that experience. So I know that for one marathon, I know kind of what that time might look like, but I really didn't know. And I didn't want to obviously, you know, go all out, you know, in Antarctica or Cape Town and then blow up the next day and have to walk for the remaining 4 races. And so I
that would make you very unpopular
myself.
On that plane if you did that.
yeah, exactly. Everybody's waiting for Eric. I was trying to kind of pace myself over the 183 miles. Yeah. And then for the last one, it was, you know, so special to be around family again. My wife and my girls were there, and so that was pretty amazing, and
mission accomplished.
And it was the final one, to your point. So I knew I didn't have anything tomorrow. I was going to lay by a pool and just do absolutely nothing. So
exactly.
But as you know, a marathon is 26.2 miles, and so it's typically you hit those 20 miles, and then you have the remaining 10K, the remaining 6 miles, and so even halfway through that race, I was feeling good, but I was still very conscious of I can't push it too hard because there's still, you know,
you
the
still
final,
have that.
There's, yeah. there's still that wall at mile 20. And so
people always laugh when I finish a marathon because I carry a lip gloss in my waist pack. And I usually like just before I come around the corner, I'll like my friend always calls it, oh, time to gloss up. I'm like, yeah, listen, just because I don't feel good, no one needs to know that. So finish with a smile and everybody will believe it was just smooth sailing the whole way. Well, let's take a quick break. When we get back, let's talk a little bit about kind of the bigger purpose of this. I mean, you did this to bring attention to Diabetes Sports Project and to inspire others, which, you know, clearly you have done. But it does get us to the question that I'm sure you're getting nonstop, and that is, what's next? We'll talk about that right after this. Do you love politics? Well, check out The Trail. Anyone who wants to be president has to go to New Hampshire first. This is a new Hearst Television podcast from our friends at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire.
How fun.
I know. The host, Adam Sexton, interviews all the people who want to live at 1600 Pennsylvania. And the way this 2020 campaign is shaping up, Adam's got a whole lot of episodes to record. Oh, you might have to help him with that. Check out The Trail from New Hampshire to the White House, wherever you get your podcasts. So when you have a baby, like 10 seconds later, people usually tend to ask you, are you going to have another? And I would imagine when you do the World Marathon Challenge to raise attention for type 1, there's probably something similar that happens.
Yes, I certainly got the questions of, you know, what's next? And I was, you know, we have two daughters, so I know how that question can go, at least on the dad side of it.
Sure.
Part of me doesn't really know, because the mission of what we're trying to accomplish with this isn't done, right? I've given, I don't know, 5 keynotes since then, and you know, podcasts, and talk to more families every week than I typically do. So the more we get the word out there about this and show people, whether they're newly diagnosed or 50 years in, that, hey, I was able to do this, and look at some of the other accomplishments out there in the community. People are doing amazing things. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason that you, as a 5-year-old, 50-year-old, whatever, can't accomplish whatever your dreams and goals are too. Sort of remove some of that fear, redefine what's possible, whether it's, you know, it's sometimes for the healthcare providers too, right? For doctors to see that we can live a very active life with type 1. So, you know, that's going to continue to go, obviously, and hopefully the story continues to be shared. Athletically, you know, I'm not totally sure what I want to do next. I know that I want to, and I'm already committed to doing it, and we've done it before, but doing more things with community, kind of with fellow type ones, whether it's running a marathon with them or some sort of a relay event or Tough Mudder, or, you know, kind of anything. I love doing events with type ones because there's a sense of bond that we as type ones, when we get together, it's unlike anything else. And I think it's as much as, you know, my wife or my best friend or our parents or whomever are there for us when it comes to type one and get it and know all about it. If you're with other type ones, there's a certain connection that you can't really have with anybody else.
Totally. And so makes to be sense. Able
to, yeah, to be able to do something and accomplish something together, like a marathon, or, you know, it just adds a certain level of specialness to it.
It must feel great when somebody says, I saw that you did this and that got me up and I figured out a way to do fill in the blank. That must feel really great. And especially with younger people too, I would think.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm not a very emotional person, but that'll get me pretty much every time. So, you know, empowering people to not be afraid and to go after their dreams is really something that I hope I have an impact on and am able to do. And people who don't have type 1 diabetes, right? There's as many of the family members or friends or colleagues or whatever who say, gosh, you know, we all have some challenge in life. And if this is my challenge, right? Type 1 diabetes is my kind of challenge, and I'm able to overcome it and continue to overcome it to live the life I want to live. So if it's, you know, high blood pressure or depression or whatever the challenge is, people with the right mindset and sort of the guidance and education or tools or whatever it might be, shouldn't be afraid to go after their goals, because, you know, we're capable of so much more than we give ourselves credit.
Yeah.
And that was one of the big takeaways from the World Marathon Challenge.
In retrospect, what's the one thing you wish you had packed for the challenge?
Oh, my gosh. probably my shoes in Antarctica were terribly wrong. So much so that after the second race, I thought I had broken my foot. I thought I had a stress fracture in my right foot, and it's this old soccer injury that kind of keeps coming back, so bad that once a doctor told me that I probably should never run, he said, can you pick another sport aside from running?
Yeah, you should send this podcast to that doctor.
I since found a different doctor. But you know, I can't, you know, I got through it and I'm standing and
so I
and
guess it was good.
Healthy and happy. So I, you know, I don't know what the heck I did, but it all kind of worked out. So.
Oh, I'm just doing research because I am serious. I want to do this someday.
I think you should do it.
I do too. I love it. All right. Well, what's a good way for people to keep up with you and the project?
You know, social media these days is such an easy way to, you know, keep track of what's going on. So Instagram, my name is very unique and original. It's Eric Tozer.
T-O-Z-E-R.
So, you know, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, Diabetes Sports Project. We're out there everywhere. And I would just, you know, encourage everybody, like I tell everybody I come across, you know, if there's somebody with type one, whether it's a parent or a kid or an adult, have them reach out. If I can help, I'll talk to them, or we'll connect them with somebody at DSP. We really want to be that resource, whether it's one-on-one communication or sort of guidance in being active, whatever we can do. That's what we're there for.
That's great. One suggestion for you. I think you need to send your wife on like the ultimate girls trip.
Oh yeah. It's happened, and it's happened this weekend. Yes.
No, smart boy.
I am not the, there's no way I would be where I am today without her. And, we as a family are beyond lucky to have her. And, I think, you know, we have two young girls, and it's wonderful to see a strong, amazing woman who's such a good role model for our girls. So
Dad's doing a pretty good job too. Don't sell yourself short there.
Like, well,
all right.
I got to try to keep up.
I know. Eric, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And congrats on completing the World Marathon Challenge.
Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.
So have you booked your ticket yet?
I have not. No, I still have, you know, like a few other things I got to do before I can get to the bucket list. But no, I mean, I hear about it and I'm like, oh, that sounds great.
Oh, man.
Wouldn't that be cool?
I can't believe it. I remember one time I was just on Instagram and randomly you were like, oh, by the way, I just ran 100 miles.
What? Well, you need to look a little closer because I've never done 100 miles, no? But I have done some of the long ones. Yeah. No, I mean, I love what he's doing and the impact he's having on generations, different generations, to get people out there and doing their thing is pretty cool. All right. Don't forget to take a screen grab of this episode if you don't mind. And if you put it in your Instagram stories, we can share it. We'd love to do that. It helps us grow the podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at RunReadSip, the show at Dying to Ask Podcast, and of course, producer Jeff.
Yeah, producer Jeff.
Pretty self-explanatory there.
Yep.
And we'll see you next time on Dying to Ask.
Bye.